Good afternoon. Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome you most warmly on behalf of the Manhattan Institute. We're so pleased you could be with us. Over a decade ago, when the homeless first began to appear in force on the streets of the nation's cities, one of America's great journalistic mystifications began to take shape. Egged on by advocates, the most visible of whom was an obviously, even spectacularly unstable character, the press spun a seamless tale of victimization. The homeless were victims of deindustrialization and gentrification, the stories contended. Their only need was housing, housing, housing. They were everywhere in the country, some 5 million of them. As portrayed in the papers and on TV, they were more often than not white two-parent families, where dad had recently lost his job in a Midwestern factory. We were all only one paycheck away from homelessness, the papers quoted the advocates as saying. And, after all, Jesus was a homeless person, an assertion a prominent political candidate recently resurrected. Now, almost none of this turned out to be true upon investigation. The quoted numbers were over 10 times greater than the real figure, as social science research later established. The demographics of the homeless did not remotely resemble the portrait the press painted, and nor, of course, was Jesus a homeless person. But it took a decade to blow the mystifications away, and even today the myths crop up regularly enough, they no longer command widespread belief. No one, really no one, played a more important role in instructing the country in who the homeless were and how they got that way than E. Fuller Torrey. His 1988 book, No Go, shows how large a percentage of the homeless were seriously mentally ill people. And he made clear how fundamental failures of policy had brought about their homelessness, a very cruel plight. Almost a decade later, in Out of the Shadows, he addressed how to deal with America's mental illness crisis. Dr. Torrey's credentials for tackling this subject are awesome. A psychiatrist who has worked in Ethiopia, Alaska, the South Bronx, and Washington St. Elizabeth Hospital. He was special assistant to the director of the National Institutes of Mental Health in the 70s, and now heads the Stanley Foundation's research programs on schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. His 16 books include the celebrated The Roots of Treason, Ezra Pound, and The Secret of St. Elizabeth's. And his more than 200 articles include several for City Journal, I'm proud to say, including Reinventing Mental Health Care, which truly could serve any compassionate conservative who makes it to the White House as a perfect blueprint for dramatically improving the lives of the unfortunate without increasing government spending by a nickel. I'm delighted to present Fuller Torrey.
Thank you very much, Myron, for the very kind introduction. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you all for coming on it. I want to thank Mabel Wheel especially for setting all of this up and inviting you all. And thank Myron personally. His book, The Dream and the Nightmare, has been, I think, a very, very important book. It certainly was influential in my thinking. And what I'm going to talk about today, briefly and quickly, is really part of the dream and the nightmare, except we're not going to spend much time talking about the dream. The dream's kind of gone now. We're going to talk about the nightmare and how to wake up from the nightmare. I am going to cover a lot of material quickly. I want to just mention that much of it is on the handout that is on your seat. Much of it is also in Out of the Shadows, the editor of whom, Joanne Miller, is here today, I might add. And much of it is included on the center material that's on the site, psychlaws.org. This is an organization that we started 2 years ago to try and start to solve some of the problems that we are going to talk about. Okay, I'm going to go over very quickly the issue of the dimensions of the disaster. But what I want you to take away today is it is a disaster. It's a continuing disaster It's like a flood or an earthquake. And when we have a flood, we don't just sit there and count the bodies as they go by. And if we have an earthquake, we don't just sit there and listen to the screams from beneath the rubble. We try and do something. And we are looking at a disaster of this magnitude, and yet we are basically just sitting there. And I think we need to do much, much better. The number of people we're talking about in New York State on any given day are on the handout. There's at least 100,000 people with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, or manic depressive illness, if you like, who are not receiving treatment on any given day in the state, and over 50,000 in the city itself. Where are they? The homeless, Myron mentioned that. At least a third of the homeless are mentally ill. Among the women, it's more like 50% to two-thirds on it. Very conservative estimate would be 2,000 to 3,000 severely mentally ill homeless in New York. Probably it's more like 5,000 to 7,000 on any given day. The fact that we don't have hard numbers, I think, tells you as much as you need to know about our failure. Secondly, where are they? They're in the jails and prisons. Rikers Island, I was noticing Rikers Island as my plane was landing this morning, and then coming over the bridge, I was looking at Manhattan State Hospital, and I was thinking, you know, most of the people in Rikers Island today who are mentally ill used to be in Manhattan State Hospital. There are more mentally ill in Rikers Island jail than in any New York State psychiatric hospital. Rikers Island, New York State jail system, is the second largest mental institution in the United States. The largest is the Los Angeles County jail system. There are more mentally ill people, severely mentally ill. These aren't including your drug and alcohol abusers. These are people with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, severe depression, usually with psychotic features. There are more severely mentally ill in New York State prisons than in all New York State psychiatric hospitals combined on it. Mr. and Mrs. Stevens are here today, whose son is in Rikers Island. A very highly publicized case of a mentally ill young man who is not being treated and who is then ends up in jail as so many others. This is not just New York. I might add, I got an article from the Tulsa World yesterday. 12% of the patients discharged from Eastern State Hospital in Oklahoma have ended up in the jail system within 6 months. We're looking at this all over the United States. So those of you who think this is a New York disaster, because New York usually has larger disasters, are wrong. This is a equal opportunity disaster. Rikers Island costs about $175 a day. Good, the best outpatient care in the United States costs about $60 a day, including housing on it. Third evidence of the disaster is the number of violent acts that we are looking at. We have estimated and been very highly criticized for saying that about 5% of all homicides in the United States, or roughly 1,000 homicides a year in the United States, are committed by severely mentally ill people who are not being treated. Now, it turns out we're conservative. NIMH came out with a report, which I will add they certainly aren't going to publicize. In fact, we had to get the release on the Freedom of Information in July of this year, saying that the real number is 10 to 15% of all homicides in the United States. And these include people who have severely mentally ill and are also abuse alcohol on it. On the handout, I listed some of the high-profile crimes that have been committed. This list goes on. I've been keeping a folder on this since the early 1980s, and the folder now increases much more rapidly than it has in the past because this is becoming severe. Example, people that like Mary Ventura and Reuben Harris and Andrew Goldstein, who is one of the most recent additions on here in terms of high publicized, who have pushed people in front of subways, and among other people, Webdale, Kendra Webdale's sister, who has been instrumental in getting the Kendra's Law passed in New York State so people like this can be treated. And also Edgar Rivera, who is here and is another example of someone who was pushed under a subway and by a mentally ill person and who lost his legs and who, and coming to in the hospital, and when it was explained to him what had happened to him, he said, well, let me see if I understand this correctly. This fellow lost his mind, but I just lost my legs. I think I came out ahead on this. I might also add that Andrew Goldstein, when he was being treated, did very well. He was in a structured group home for a year, took his medications, and did fine. When he wasn't on his medication, he was acutely psychotic and chronically psychotic and committed some 13 assaults before he finally killed Ms. Webdale on it. Fourth, the increasing use of police time. I have the figures on here on the number of emotionally disturbed persons, or as the police call them, EDPs, picked up. 1976, it was about 1,000. 1998, it was almost 25,000 people a year. It's just another measure. And the important thing, if you take nothing else away from it today, I want you to realize it is getting worse, and is getting worse every year. British Journal just published a very interesting article from Sweden showing that the mortality of people with schizophrenia increased 50% over the last 20 years, and the mortality in terms of violent deaths in of deaths associated with violence tripled during that time. The fifth piece of evidence, these are all, so far we're talking about what happens to persons, is the fiscal cost. And no one really has really realized how much money we are wasting by not treating people with severe mental illnesses. I have the figures on page 3 for federal expenditures alone for supporting people with severe psychiatric disorders. They have increased between 1987 and 1997 from $14.4 billion to $37.8 billion. And on the next page, I have some data on the rapid increase of the SSI and the SSDI, say nothing of Medicaid and Medicare. The increases in SSI and SSDI are among the fastest growing parts of the federal budget on it. This is an enormous waste of money on it. And I think that in the past 12 years, payments alone have increased almost $500 million each year. The main reason is because we are not treating the people who we should be treating. And I also put a little box down there to tell you what $37.8 billion is in terms of the federal budget, because I don't know about you, but it's just a lot of zeros to me. But when I realize that the amount of money that we're spending on the severely mentally ill is 12 times the budget for all federal prisons and 4 times the budget for the FBI and all federal law enforcement activities, then I start to realize that this is an awful lot of money that we are not spending very well. Okay, what I want to spend the larger part of time on is the solutions. I think we can all agree that it is a disaster. I'm not sure we can all agree on the solutions, but I'm going to tell you the 5 elements that I think have to go into solutions if we really want to solve this. One of the solutions, incidentally, is not more money. New York State Department of Mental Health, Office of Mental Health, has a budget of $2.5 billion. New York State spends $112 per capita for every man, woman, and children. That is almost twice the national average. It is more than any other state. The next state is Connecticut with $99, and I'm sure that there are people in this room who won't agree that you don't need more money, but I can tell you that it's not a question of more money. It's a question of how the money is being spent, how the money should be spent. Okay, 5 things are necessary. One is that you've got to decide who's responsible, and that we haven't done very well. We did until the 60s. The states were responsible. Back in the 1840s, we held the counties responsible, but for 100 years, we held the states responsible. Since the 1960s, it's not at all clear who's responsible. The city says the state's responsible. The state says the feds are responsible. The feds say everyone's responsible except them. And a lot of the mess is coming from our inability and failure to fix the point of responsibility, of accountability. And you certainly see that here. I know it's like a tag team wrestling match here between New York and Albany and Washington. And we need to clearly establish who is responsible, give them the money, and then hold them accountable. And all of those things are part of it. Part of this is also what we call the IMD exclusion. This is, in their infinite wisdom, the feds, when they were setting up these programs 20 years ago, said, well, we shouldn't pay for someone who's in Pilgrim State Hospital. But if they're out of Pilgrim State Hospital, then they're eligible for federal funds. Well, I think any of you with an IQ of more than 90 can figure out that it's not going to take Albany very long to figure out that every time they discharge people from the state hospitals and close down those beds, they effectively save state money. This is what the IMD exclusion is all about. In the box there, I gave you some figures that actually came recently from Oregon. If someone is in the state hospital, my sister right now in upstate New York is in the state hospital. She is costing, if she were in Oregon, $114,000. In New York State, it's more than that. By discharging her, and they discharge her on a regular basis, anytime she's even kind of semi-not psychotic, they discharge her, because that's the main modus operandi of Albany, is discharge people as soon as you can. You get them into any kind of community facility or community hospital, you immediately cut the cost less than half for the state. And if you can get them into a group home, you cut it down to more like a fifth. So that you transfer the money, you transfer the cost. I'm sorry, you transfer the cost to Washington. That is really what's driving the system. People in offices of mental health throughout the country at the state level, their main job is to figure out how they can shift the cost to the federal government. And that doesn't take account of the patient's needs. Okay, that's the first thing we need to do, is establish a point of accountability, give them the money, and hold them accountable. How do you hold them accountable? You hold them accountable, number two, by reimbursing on the basis of outcomes. You measure what happens. You don't have 5,600 Medicaid regulations and say, you can fund this, but you can't fund that. What you do is you say, we are going to measure the outcome. We are going to measure how many people are in Rikers who have severe mental illnesses. We're going to measure how many people are homeless in Central Park on any given day. And then you fund the system based on the outcomes. And yes, you can do this in the private sector, and I certainly think, in having worked with the unions in the public sector, that the private sector has a lot to commend it. But you can't do it the way we've done it, by giving the money to Charter, which just now went bankrupt, because they're very skillful at taking only the easy patients and leaving the difficult patients alone. And you can't do it with the nonprofits unless you assign the cases where you measure the outcomes, where you reimburse them for doing a good job. Right now, if you put a contract out, as we do all the time, you reimburse on the basis of they make more money for seeing fewer patients. You have to turn that whole thing around, and you have to reimburse on the basis of the outcomes of the patients that they're seeing. And that includes unannounced program inspections. It includes things like the New York State Commission on Quality of Care did at one time, but which has been pretty much dismantled. And that was a good program at one time, but like many things in New York State, has really gone downhill. Probably would improve if it were taken out from under the governor and put in under the legislature, where it was more independent on it. Third, most importantly, you have to focus on the people who need the services. And this is a major problem in New York State. It's the difference between mental health and mental illness. I brought along the poster down on the end here just to remind you. These are a pair of twins that I looked at in one of our research programs several years ago, in which the twin on the left is a well, these are identical twins, so they started out with the same brains. The twin on the left is the well twin. The twin on the right has schizophrenia, and you can see the loss of brain tissue is reflected on the large ventricles. These are brain diseases we're dealing with. This is like Parkinson's disease or Alzheimer's disease. These are not something that has to do with the mother looking at them cross-eyed. This has nothing to do with social skills, training. When New York State is spending its money, it's spending its money often on things like a program in Orange County, the Friends program, that targets, quote, children and adolescents who live at home, have emotional problems, and lack social skills. Well, that's certainly both of my children would fit into that program, and I suspect a lot of your children would too on it. What you have to do, if you really want to solve it, is perhaps take the Office of Mental Health as it exists now and put it under the State Department of Health. It's a medical undertaking that we're talking about. Interestingly, the State Office of Mental Health talks about clients. They don't talk about patients. Patients are politically incorrect now. The Department of Health talks about patients. We have to go back and talk about patients, because these people have brain diseases. Fourth, we need to change the laws and then enforce them, so that when we are basing our laws, we're basing them on the need of people for care, parens patriae, as we call. The state has a obligation to take care of people who cannot take care of themselves. Out of this came Kendra's Law in New York State this past year, a year ago now, And I might add people like Attorney General Spitzer was absolutely instrumental in getting that through, and Governor Pataki was a very important supporter of that. He is not being well served by the people in the Office of Mental Health who refuse to use the law. The vast majority of counties in New York have not used it yet. And it's a good law and really should be used. Dennis Safran is also here from the Center for Community Interest, who also played a major role in that. And, of course, people like the Webdale family and Edgar Rivera, it would not have gone through without their help. We started a year and a half ago the Treatment Advocacy Center, and that's what the brochure on your chair is about, in Washington to try and change the laws, not only in New York State but in all of the other states, so people can be treated, who most of whom don't know that they're sick, before they end up in jail, before they end up committing some kind of violent crime on it. Fifth and final, we need to get the National Institutes of Mental Health to do the job that it's being paid to do. Most of you don't realize that the National Institute of Mental Health does almost everything except support research on severe mental illnesses. And last week we published this report, which I'll be glad to send any of you. We didn't bring copies, but if you want it, just let me know, called Missions Impossible, which details the ongoing failure of the National Institutes of Mental Health to do the research on severe mental illnesses that will lead to better treatments. And they are not doing that. A NIMH study, the one that was just referred to a few minutes ago that was released recently, said that 70% of the cost of all mental illness treatment are for severe mental illnesses, specifically schizophrenia, manic depression, severe depression, OCD, etc. We then looked at the most recent group of research grants that NIMH is putting out. Only 22% of the research grants have anything to do with severe mental illness, and only 8% have anything to do with the treatment of severe mental illness. So basically they have data, NIMH has data that says 70% of our costs are associated with the treatment of severe mental illnesses. However, we will only invest 8% of our research funds, extramural research funds, in these. And then on the back page here, I gave you a few examples of this. In the 1999 portfolio, only seven research projects that were funded were related to the treatment of manic depressive illness, and there were also seven that were related to the study of pigeons, which is one of the specialties of NIMH. Only four were related to the treatment of severe obsessive compulsive disorder, four were related to fish, eight were related to the treatment of severe panic disorder, and eight were related to songbirds. The grandiosity of NIMH in thinking that every social problem is somehow their problem to solve, and by the way, if we have enough left over, then we'll do something about severe mental illnesses, you would not believe until you look at their portfolio. If NIMH was a patient, I would recommend that it be put on lithium. In conclusion, what I want you to remember is that we are witnessing a disaster. It is an ongoing disaster. It is a disaster that is getting worse. It is a disaster with both personal and economic dimensions, and the disaster is caused by our failure to treat people with severe mental illnesses. We know how to fix the system. We know that programs like Fountain House, like the PAC program, like the St. Francis residents here in New York, we know these work. We know how to do it. But our system of funding is set up in a way that it makes those programs very, very difficult to implement on it. The biggest danger is that even though we're in the midst of a disaster, we're used to the disaster now. I first visited New York 50 years ago, and I remember visiting New York. It was a very different city at that time on it. And the thing that I'm afraid of is that, like a flood, and the water has come up very slowly, and it's around our ankles now, and we think, well, it's always been around our ankles. We don't need to do anything about it. Or if you're in an earthquake in northern Turkey and the ground is always shaking, and you say, well, it's not a disaster because kind of the ground is always shaking. I think that's the biggest danger we face now, is that we are so used to looking at the severely mentally ill on the streets. We're getting so used to looking at them in Rikers and in the jail system. We're getting so used to seeing the episodes of violence committed by them, is that we simply accept and say, this is the way things always were. This isn't the way things always were. And in fact, I think we can do much better. Thank you. be happy to answer any questions or yes.
No. And the second question is, if you have measures and outcomes and evaluate your progress in that way, wouldn't you run the danger that keeping people in hospitals would be looked at as the worst outcome, because after all, it's the most restrictive alternative, and yet having more people in hospitals might, in fact, from the standpoint of medicine, of a certain number of people, be the best thing for
them? The answer to the first Israel Jean Isaac, who has written really the seminal book on the history of how we got into the mess that we're in now. It's an excellent book that the Treatment Advocacy Center has just put back in print on it. The IMD exclusion is going to be a political issue. I don't have any magic on that. We were given a grant a year ago to have someone in our Treatment Advocacy Center just focus on this issue. And we're... The IMD exclusion is the issue where Washington says to New York State, we will not fund anyone who's in Pilgrim State Hospital. That's your, because we don't want to do that. But, however, once the person is out of Pilgrim State Hospital, then they're eligible for all of Washington funds. Of course, this creates the huge incentive to shut down all the beds in Pilgrim State Hospital and everywhere else, and that is one of the major causes of the problem. If, in fact, you had the funding at a single level and there was no incentive for New York State to either put people in the hospital or out of the hospital, some people belong in the hospital. My sister is very psychotic right now, and she belongs in the hospital and probably will for many months. There must be hospitals for people like that on it. So that, no, you would not necessarily have worse outcomes if the person was in the hospital. And I have in Out of the Shadows, I spent part of a chapter talking about how you would set up a program to measure outcomes, what kind of outcomes you can measure. We've got a lot of information now on quality of life measures. You can do this. We don't do it because that's not the way we're funding the system on it. But you certainly can do it. But in terms of changing the IMD exclusion, I don't have any magic on it. I would personally think it's more likely to happen in a Republican administration than Democratic administration, but I could be fooled on that. Yeah.
Why do you think the frequency of mental illness is rising so rapidly?
We don't know that the frequency is rising, although I must admit there is some evidence that during the last half of the century that it may have risen, but we don't know that for a fact. What we do know is that the problem is greater, because remember, in 1955, most of these people were in the state hospital system. In 1955, there was 96,000 people in the New York State system. If we had the same number of people in the New York State system today, because there's been a 15% increase in population, we would have 110,000 people in the state hospitals. Instead, we have less than 7,000 people in the state hospitals. And in fact, if you count all of the people who are in hospitals, group homes, residences, any kind of housing in New York State now, you come up only with about 50,000 people. So in fact, we have lost somewhere between 50 and 60,000 people. We haven't lost them. They're in Rikers. They're in somewhere in their own homes. They're on the streets. And some of them are dead. It's just that they're much more visible now than they ever were. And I'm not saying we ought to go back and put them all in Pilgrim State Hospital. Only a handful of them do need to be there, my sister being one of them. But we need to have the availability at Pilgrim State Hospital, and most importantly, we have to make sure that they stay on their medicine when they leave. Half of them don't realize that they're sick. They have brain damage to part of the frontal lobe where they don't think they're sick. Where I am told on a regular basis, Doc, if you think this medicine's so great, you take it. There's nothing wrong with me. Yeah.
Well, I want to think of pollution. Quality of pollution is a definitional morality. A lot of normal people were what most people would regard as normal are now committing crimes that seem to be crimes that only people with mental disease would do. For example, the Columbine situation. For example, the youth out there in Queens who mugged and killed the Chinese liberator. People who came from quote-unquote good homes, religious homes, did not exhibit this mental disorder. And then you, and assuming you can identify, and round up the so-called mentally diseased, as you say, a lot of them will not take their medicine. And my question, therefore, to you is, assuming you can find them and light them and force them to take their medicine, how do you, why would a free society lock up people who are quote-unquote mentally diseased as opposed to those people who have committed crimes against society, often not for the crime, including those people who argue that they had a mental disease at the time they committed the crime, but in a civil, in a criminal trial that found that having found been not mentally diseased. So my question to you is, how many people do you want to lock up? And who's going to define who's mentally diseased? You, as opposed to doctors who say there is no mental disease?
Well, let me just say, first of all, I'm not talking about the youth who killed the delivery man in Queens. I obviously haven't examined them, but there's no evidence that I saw in anything that was published that they're severely mentally ill. No evidence in anything that I saw from the Columbine that those young men were severely mentally ill, and I'm certainly not proposing a program today that is supposed to abolish crime. I'm talking about a small percentage of people who do commit severe crimes who are severely mentally ill. And we're not talking about people who just look strange to you or a little eccentric. We're talking about people who have schizophrenia, manic depressive illness, and in terms of are these brain diseases or not, I would add that that's my real life, is the evidence is overwhelming that these are brain diseases now. Thomas Zoss and his era are long gone at this point. We have physical evidence. We can measure differences in the brain in a large variety of ways that these people have severe brain diseases. In terms of, you're also implying that I want to lock everyone up. In fact, I think we'd have to lock up very, very few. What we find is that when you implement something like Kendra's Law, for people who don't know that they're sick. My sister's a good example. My sister was hospitalized for 25 years, and I asked her, Rhoda, do you think that you have schizophrenia? And she'll smile, and she'll say, well, I know you think I have schizophrenia. And I'll say, well, you know, you were in the hospital for 25 years in a row. Why do you think they kept you there? And she'll say, you know, I don't know at all. I had a cold when I went in the hospital. She has 0.0 insight, awareness of her illness on it. And that is because she has damage to the parts of the frontal lobe that we use to think about ourselves. And between 40 and 50% of people who have schizophrenia and manic depressive illness have this kind of damage so that they don't think they're sick. So that Mr. Goldstein would not take his medicine on his own because there was nothing wrong with him on it. He would only take his medicine when he was in a group home and when the medicine was being supervised. You don't need to lock up many people at all. You do need to monitor their medications, and that's what we're talking about.
What you say, Dr. Story, seems just eminently fair and reasonable, and I can't imagine anything here agreeing with you. But there must be...
They do all the
time. But there must be an opportunity for you. And what would a doctor, what would another doctor, on the other side, and what would he say? He hasn't been here. What's you and his opinion? So, you know, the brain is damaged. It's all there. It's all clear. I believe it completely. I believe what you said. But, say we got Dr.
X, the
same
house. What would you say? Well, the other side, of course, is the civil libertarian side saying that we should never treat people involuntarily. We don't treat people involuntarily for their heart disease. We don't treat them involuntarily for the rheumatoid arthritis. Why would you treat them involuntarily? Because they have a brain disease. And the difference is that we make the assumption that someone with heart disease is able to think clearly about their heart disease. I know I have a heart disease. I don't want your bloody medicine. I'm not going to take it. We see that all the time. I know I have breast cancer. You're recommending this to me, doctor. I don't think it's going to work. I'm going to take some herbs. We allow that all the time. If, however, the person has brain disease, that's different. For example, Alzheimer's is a brain disease. If Mrs. Jones in upstate New York in the middle of the winter decides she wants to walk outside without shoes and socks on, we don't say to Mrs. Jones in the early stages of Alzheimer's, Mrs. Jones, we don't think it's a good idea, but we're going to defend your civil liberties to do this. We're doing exactly this with people with schizophrenia and manic depressive illness all of the time. Ms. Stevens.
When you talk about the person who says, there's nothing wrong with me, I don't need this medicine, you're talking about my son. He said all the time, Mom, you want me to be a drug addict. You take the medicine. There's nothing wrong with him. However, since this incident, and he has been in a psychiatric hospital, and now he's in Rikers, he seems to believe that, he seems to accept that he has a mental condition. Now, I'm wondering, is that just to get out? Is that just what he's saying because we want to hear it? Or does he really now understand that he has a mental condition, which means he has to take medicine for the rest of his life?
I know a lot of people who, when they are very psychotic, have no awareness of their illness, but you get them on medicine and they have good awareness of their illness. A lot of people like that. I know other people who you get them on medicine, they still have no awareness of their illness and won't take medicine under any circumstances. We're supporting a research trial right now using videotaping people like your son when they come on the ward acutely psychotic. And then as you get them on medicine and stabilize them, playing the videotape back to them to see if you can get them to realize what they look like and what they acted like during a period of acute psychosis to see whether this will change their level of awareness or not. We don't know whether it will work. Some preliminary studies we've done suggest that in some people it will change. And they will realize then that, oh yes, I don't remember that at all. Because most people on acute psychosis don't remember the times when they're really psychotic. But that's the kind of thing that we're doing. But they're still going to be left with a group of people who are not aware that they're sick. They don't realize they're sick. And unless we are willing to use things like Kendra's Law that says, yes, we know you're dangerous when you're not on medication. If you want to live in the community, you're going to have to take medication. That we're going to have to face that very, very directly. And that is, of course, antithetical to many civil libertarians. Yes, Judge.
Let me indicate, I think the distinction between the health of the heart and the mind is one is a danger to oneself or others. I mean, that's really the distinction of why you're able to force somebody to take that medicine. And there is a balancing of rights of the party which has to be taken into account. You don't want to just put people on medicine who may not belong on medicine. The other two items that I'd like to just bring out is that in Rikers Island, for example, the amount of stay of a defendant is 200 days versus 42 days of a non-mentally ill person. And the third danger, which really no one has really spoken to as of yet, is what is happening in the family courts and with younger people. There was a survey that was recently done that in the rate of mental disorder in the youth facilities throughout this nation is between 50% and 75%, which tells you that once that person now is growing up, what will the result be? And if we're not going to be doing something at the present time, the future looks much more bleaker than it is even today.
I'd just like to comment on the second point,
especially. There's absolutely no question that people with severe mental illnesses spend much more time in both jails and prisons for exactly the same crime. And that's true all across the states. That's well documented. In terms of having checks and balances, of course we need checks and balances. None of us are talking of going back to the 1930s where I, as a psychiatrist, could sign you into Pilgrim State Hospital on the basis of my signature alone, you know, because I don't like the way you look. And that was true, actually, up till that time. We developed a model law out of the Treatment Advocacy Center, which is in your program, which has now been released a few months ago, to try and set up a law where assisted treatment would be possible, but with checks and balances. When I used outpatient commitment, which is one form of assisted treatment in the District of Columbia, which I used during the 8 years I was working at St. Elizabeth's, I always had public defenders who would come in court and who would argue very strenuously against what I was trying to do. And that's exactly the way it should be.
Interesting enough, there is sufficient funding at the present time that the legislature passed to implement Kendra's Law, and the money is not being used. Usually, it's just the reverse. Usually, the law is there and there is never the funding to implement it. But at the present moment, just today, the change because as Kendra is being used more and more and being used by the prisons and probation and so forth, that will change. But today, there are teams out there, but teams that go out to make sure that the person is utilizing their medicine. That's a wonderful part of the law. The money is there and it's not being used at all at present.
Thanks very much. And like I said, Burgess is just starting one of the first mental health court in New York State, in Brooklyn, which is good. Yes.
Let me kind of preface this with where I was 5 years ago. I was chief of the New York City Trinity Police. And when I think about the issue of mental illness, I guess, you know, I focus on those horrendous incidents that happened within the subway and the ability of the police to protect people and the dichotomy that exists in protecting the mentally ill and protecting the public. What opinion do you have as to the role of police officers in making public places safe and protecting the rights of both the mentally ill and the public at large?
The police throughout the United States are now the first line mental health workers. In Cincinnati and two counties in California, studies have shown that they now respond to mental illness calls more often than robbery calls on it. I've worked with police in various capacities, and I've also visited jails in about 16 states, and I find two things. Number one, I'm very impressed with the efforts that police make to work with severely mentally ill people, especially police who have had virtually no training on this. Number two, I find them all incredulous as to why they have become mental health workers when in fact they signed up to catch robbers. And this is a major problem. We are in the Treatment Advocacy Center, we are finding a lot of support from the police, from the sheriffs, because they are the ones who are really suffering in the sense that they're having to deal with these issues all over the United States. When you have the number of severely mentally ill people who are not being treated, 50,000 literally in New York today, you could have a transit authority police force of almost an infinite number, and you're not going to be able to guarantee public safety simply because of the number of severely mentally ill people who are not being treated, who are delusional, and who decide when they see you on the street that you are the one that's sending the rays in their head, or you are the one that implanted the chip in their left ear that's been making these noises in their head all along. And once they decide that, they may hit you with a brick or almost anything. I think it's extraordinary that I know how many people that I treated in St. Elizabeth's Hospital who are on the streets of Washington now. I see them on the streets. I know how sick they are, and I know how sick they when they came onto the ward. I also know how well they look on medication. And I'm not surprised that we see the number of public incidents. I'm surprised we don't see more. Any other questions?
What politics does it take to accomplish this? For example, how much of what you want done can be accomplished by just imposing the different administrators and healthcare financing authority? How much of it can be done by executive order? There are so many excellent reforms that require the undoing of years of Supreme Court decisions, so we know that that's a very tough prospect. Politically, how feasible
I think much of what I'm talking about, Myron, could be done by executive order. I think in terms of the appointments to federal agencies like HCFA, like the woman just resigned yesterday who's in charge of that, the Center for Mental Health Services, for example, which is a hopeless, I mean, of all of our federal agencies, the Center for Mental Health Services is right up near the top. That's a federal appointment. The directorship of NIMH can do some. The directorship of NIH. I would say that two-thirds, I'm just off the top of my head, two-thirds of what needs to happen could be done by executive order at the federal or the state level, if anyone wanted to. But so far, nobody has wanted to. The one-third probably involves legislative, you would have to pass certain, the IMD exclusion, for example, I think would have to be passed, you'd have to pass congressional authorization to change that. Similarly, at the state, you would have to pass certain things in the state legislature. One of the nice things about what I'm doing is that, and what I've been working on for more years than I want to remember, is it's not a Republican issue and it's not a Democratic issue. This disaster has been presided over by an equal number of Republican and Democrat presidents on it, none of whom seem to understand the issue at all or have much interest in it, I might add. The last one who did was John Kennedy, and that kind of went by the board because they made some very bad decisions during his remaining years, during his late tenure on there. You can. It's a political issue. If you want to get concerned about the number of severely mentally ill homeless or the mentally ill in jails, some of my most liberal friends can really get worked up over that. It's also a very conservative issue because if you look at the amount of money that is being spent on these programs and on the federal budget of SSI, SSDI, Medicaid, Medicare, it's a scandal what's being wasted on that. So you can come in from the far left, the far right, or anywhere in between. That's the nicest part of what I'm doing. So I'll be glad to send you a copy of our report, but that's the mindset of NIMH. The mindset of NIMH is that they should be doing a little bit of everything, but not too much of anything. And yes, we will do a little bit on schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. The main reason they're doing lots and lots of these psychologists, and they need something to do. And working with pigeons is one of the things that they can do. Now, it's not that this research is worthless. Some of it is quite good, but some of it should be funded by other agencies, and this is in our report in some detail, and especially by the National Science Foundation. NIMH should do the job that they're primarily set up to do when they're not doing that. Yeah.
We talked about all the people in jails and prisons and the streets. What about the earlier cohort, the younger cohort? Is there a similar group in foster care and juvenile justice systems, in special educational settings, or is the nature of the disease something that whatever problems they have is a different issue? Is there an adolescent equivalent of the issues you've been talking about, and should we be doing something there as well?
The vast majority of cases of schizophrenia and manic depressive illness or bipolar disorder start in the late teens or the 20s. There is a subset, relatively small subset, of juvenile onset schizophrenia. There is a debatably large subset of juvenile onset bipolar disorder that we're really just starting to focus on for the first time. But by and large, it's not a large subset of that. Heather McDonald, in a very, very important article in the City Journal, discussed the increasing use of SSI and SSDI, sometimes appropriately but often inappropriately, for all kinds of problems of adolescence. And I think that was one of the more important studies that has been done on that. But by and large, what I'm talking about is a problem of adults, and it's much less a problem of adolescents. We've got lots of problems with adolescents, but mercifully, schizophrenia and bipolar disorder is not the largest part of it.
I wanted to go back to dangers to self and others. I work at a drop-in center, and there is one individual who's clearly mentally ill, but he's stabilized. Anyone who's ever worked with him, well, that's the way he is. The emergency medical teams that come in, he identifies himself with four different names, and you know, we all see him at different times screaming at cars and taxis and in subways, but somehow he's never a danger to self and others when the team comes in. Can Kendra's Law, is there a way for that to work to help him get the services? Because, of course, he does not want any services. He won't see the doctor. He won't. How do you help him?
Of course, exactly why we pushed to get Kendra's Law implemented, so that people like him, and again, I'd have to look at exactly what his behavior is, and Mary Zadanowicz may want to comment on this in terms of it would be applicable. And my understanding is that someone who is that disabled can be hospitalized at least long enough to see whether he responds to medication or not. There's a lot. Kendra's Law is not perfect. There's a statement in your handout on Kendra's Law and how it be used. But it certainly is why Many of us work to get it passed so that people like that could be given a trial on medication to see whether he responds to medication or not on it. That's a very typical scenario on it. It also involves, what do you mean by danger to self or others? Half to two-thirds of the women I know on the street, certainly in Washington, have been raped or severely mentally ill. To me, that's a danger to self. People who are eating out of a garbage can, of which about 25% of the severely mentally ill use garbage cans as their primary food source, I'd say that's a danger to self. But a lot of this then comes in the interpretation. Judge Gerges can certainly comment on this, that it depends on what you see as a danger to self. If you are a devout civil libertarian, you may define, as some people have said, danger to self, danger to other means that you either are trying to kill your psychiatrist or you're trying to kill yourself in front of your psychiatrist, and anything short of that will not qualify. But okay. Kim? Kim Webdale is the sister of the woman who was killed and who was instrumental in getting the Kendra's Law passed.
Dr. Torrey, how do you propose that we deal with the mentally ill offenders who also, we know that they're mentally ill, but they may also know that they are sick and be aware of the nature and consequences of their actions? How do you propose that we deal with them so they're not only treated in a compassionate way, but also in our retribution-oriented society are also punished for their actions? And also, isn't treating people on the front line automatically as an EDC as opposed to sending people to jail, or, you know, when they're dealt with as an EDP, many times they won't have a criminal record. I think that sometimes perpetuates the problem and actually gives people a blanket excuse to use their illness to commit violent crimes. If you're not held accountable for your actions, how are you ever supposed to be punished, and what would prevent you from being violent again?
You're asking a question at the interface between psychosis and sociopathy or antisocial behavior, and it's a very difficult interface. I worked for a year and a half in the forensic division at St. Elizabeth's Hospital with people who were both mad and bad, as we used to say on it. I think the important thing to remember is that, like Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's disease, schizophrenia and manic depressive illness are equal opportunity diseases. They affect people who pre-existing have very kind personalities, and they also affect people who pre-existing were mean people, and there are mean people out there. And so that when you get the combination of someone who was somewhat antisocial and then they have the psychosis on top of it, you have a difficult treatment situation. You have to look at each individually. If you put the person on antipsychotic medications, you're not going to cure their sociopathy. What you're going to do is you're going to delusions and hallucinations. This is a major problem. When the functioning should pass, and then going to court and saying to the judge, it's okay, we can let this person go. The key thing, again, is maintenance. If the person is mandated to remain on medication, where the jails and the prisons are good for it. But you have to separate those two things. They are independent on it.